Real Life, the program that talks about the life of real estate in the Hamptons and the North Fork. The people, the places, and the things that are the pulse and heartbeat of life on the East End. And now, Associate Broker of Sotheby's International Realty, your host, John Christopher.
Welcome back to Real Life, and this is your host, John Christopher. And today, I have as my guest two lovely ladies, Allison Schmidt and Katie Dornhofer, from Cook Marin Insurance. Hi, guys. How are you today?
I'm doing great, John. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. It's great to have you both on the show. I'm going to start out with you, Allison, okay? How are homeowners insurance companies addressing the increase in homes being rented out on home sharing websites like Airbnb and HomeAway?
Great question, John. So the insurance industry tends to be a little slow in catching on with new trends, but they are addressing these exposures where the homes are being rented out on these home sharing websites in several ways. Some of them say they just absolutely will not insure homes that are rented out at all, whether it's on, you know, an annual basis or weekend basis. Others are putting some parameters in place to limit the amount of the amount that the home is rented. For example, you know, one insurance company, what they say is you can rent your home up to 16 weeks a year, but to no more than two different tenants. So that really eliminates that hotel room type of exposure.
Gotcha.
Where where you would find on Airbnb and HomeAway. And then and then there are some who are coming out with a home sharing endorsements where they'll charge extra premium and allow that type of exposure. But you know, you always really do have to make a call to your broker and check with your insurance company to see if that would be covered.
So are they saying this in the policies when they issue policies? Does it have a what do they call it, an amendment, an addendum, or
if they added an endorsement? Yes,
endorsement.
It would be added to the policy. In other cases, it wouldn't be actually listed in the policy, but it would be part of the underwriting guidelines that they provide to the agent or broker who is issuing the policy.
So should a homeowner be calling their insurance company, or do they just take it on the fly and then all of a sudden say, "Hi, Allison. Hi, Katie. How do I..." I had this tenant and the tenant messed up the house.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what do you say to them? Tough beans?
In some cases, yes, that can be the case. You always want to make that call before you rent the home out give a tenant access to your home. So, you know what you're covered for prior, and there are no surprises if, God forbid, there was a loss to occur while the tenant was staying there.
So do you notify the insurance company that it's a rental, or notifying the agent that's good enough?
It would really depend on the situation. You know, if it falls within the parameters that the carrier allows, there would be no reason to tell the carrier.
Okay. It's only if something happens and you say, "Well, we were notified about this,
yes.
So we knew."
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you tell the insured, basically, you know, you're covered, don't worry about it, or you're not covered.
That's right. Yes.
And that's when they find out if they're covered or not covered.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So what happens if they're not covered?
Well, we actually do have a situation right now where...
I love prison situations.
We have a client who never disclosed that the home was going to be tenant occupied. It was actually on an annual basis, though. And unfortunately, on Valentine's Day of this year, the house burnt to the ground. And the carrier went out and they investigated the claim, determined that there were tenants living in the home. There were tenants always living in the home, even at the time that the house was purchased. They purchased it the year prior. And
did they live there?
The tenants
owners?
Were there.
No, but did the owners live there?
They never lived there, but they told us that they lived there. That's what the application reflected. That the carrier went out and did an inspection. They maintained that was their primary residence. And once this claim occurred and the carrier investigated further, it was determined that there were tenants there. and the claim was actually just denied last week.
Wow.
And the client is now on the hook for $500,000 to rebuild their home.
Wow.
So it's not a good situation. We never like to deal with those things. But yeah,
they,
I mean,
when they got the insurance from you, but they didn't say to you at the time when they were getting the insurance and buying the house, oh, by the way, this is going to be an investment property?
They never did. No. Unfortunately. So, and, you know, I think sometimes people are afraid to that they're going to give us the wrong answer. There's never a wrong answer. You know, tell us.
So honestly.
Absolutely. Right. So that we can make sure, you know, there's always a solution out there.
Right.
But we need the correct information to get put that solution together.
So let's say they weren't thinking of trying to save a buck, you know, or thinking that they won't get the insurance. Let's just say that, okay, yeah, we're going to buy this house. And, you know, 2 weeks later, the husband says to the wife, you know what? I like where we are. Why don't we just make this into an investment property and rent it?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, even still, the insurance company could say, really?
They could, if they had never moved into that home and called that their primary residence, absolutely that could be considered misrepresentation. Once the occupancy of the home changes, you really do need to disclose that to your broker or your agent.
What if they did live there? In other words,
well, we actually have a lot of situations like that where, you know, this was. You know, we've insured the home for 30 years. Then the client moved down to Florida, let's say, and now they're renting out the home and there's been a claim. You know, that's going to be a little harder for the carrier to deny.
But they still could.
Absolutely.
So in other words, if you move, say, down to Florida, like you just said,
mm-hmm.
There's a possibility that the insurance company will say, sorry, you know, you're not there. Right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's why having an insurance broker is really important, because you're going to have those conversations most of the time versus someone who's with a Geico or an Allstate where you don't really have the relationship there.
Right.
So hopefully, you know, those conversations are going to come up, life changes are going to come up, and we can address them before there's a situation. But like Allison said, you know, I definitely think that it's a little bit harder to completely deny something if someone's been with a carrier for 30 years and it truly was, you know, they didn't realize they had to notify the carrier. I think that that's going to be a little bit more gray, but they could 100% per the contract deny the claim.
Well, what happens, okay, if the owner decides, like Airbnb, they have a basement, okay, and they say, well, geez, I'll rent the basement out for 2 weeks or I'll rent it out for the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And they're living there. What happens then?
So that's different. That's a lot of standard homeowners policies will allow you to have a certain amount of boarders, I guess it's considered.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely, you know, that changes things. It's not a full rental exposure. The landlord's there. You know, from a carrier standpoint, I think there's a little bit less of an exposure just because the actual homeowner's in the home, occupying the home there if something happens. So that's definitely, you know, that differs. There's not,
okay,
you know.
So is there, just curiosity, investment property as compared to a residential property, the person's living there and a person buys an investment property, is the premium going to be that much different?
No, it really shouldn't be. I mean, there can be limited markets for non-owner occupied homes, but
you can find insurance for that.
Absolutely. And, you know, in the case that I was telling you about where that claim was denied, in that case, had they disclosed to us the true occupancy of the home, there probably would have been the exact same rate.
Right.
There probably wouldn't have been a difference.
I hate to cut you guys short, but I definitely would like to know, how can somebody get some of that the education that you guys have and the knowledge, how can they get in touch with you guys?
So, again, my name is Allison Schmidt. I work out of our Southampton office at Cook Marin, and my direct phone number is 631-702-8514.
What is it again?
631-702-8514.
Okay.
And my name is Katie Dornhofer. I'm located primarily in the East Hampton office, and my direct line is 631-329-7224.
Again.
631-329-7224.
Ladies, it's been delightful having both of you on the program. This is John Christopher, your host of Real Life, broadcasting on WPPB 88.3, the only NPR station on Long Island, and we'll be right back with our next guest, the extraordinary owner of Il Cappuccino in Sag Harbor, Jack Tagliasocchi.
Support for 88.3 comes from Sotheby's International Realty, local experts worldwide. With over 100 international offices, Sotheby's has four Hamptons locations in Southampton, Bridgehampton, Easthampton, and Sag Harbor. Learn more at john.christopher@sotheby'shomes.com.
Welcome back to Real Life, and this is your host, John Christopher. And today I have, we're going to repeat with Jack Tagliasocchi, who is the owner of Il Cappuccino in Sag Harbor. Jack, welcome back.
Thank you.
Yes, the last time we were talking, and I had to cut you a little short, we were talking about how you got out here to Sag Harbor. So can you just give us a little background again?
Sure, I'm going to do, you know, a resume more or less.
Okay.
When I came to Sag Harbor, I was hired from Barry Brother, of which at that time they owned Barron's Covin. And Barron's Covin, when I looked before I even started, was they have one small dining room, very typical. You know, they had a lot of antique. It seated at that time about 120 people. And but he was going to expand there and build a new dining room on a wing, which he will hold over 150 to 175 people, including the bar. And he needed, you know, an executive chef to run more or less the show. And eventually come over and I look at the place and I liked the place. It was still in construction. And it was also in construction another 40-room motel next door to it, because originally it was only 12. And when we have time, another time, I tell you a story about that place. But anyway, I started over there with them. I think it was about 1964, and I ran it for almost 16 years. Eventually, I purchased the restaurant. They gave me a great opportunity, you know, the Frank and Bob Berry. And then eventually I bought the building. And then when I sold the building, I moved to East Hampton, bought a property, and I opened another Italian restaurant. Meanwhile, I always had cappuccino.
So you had, at the time, like two restaurants
going? I always had two restaurants going at the same time. First was Barron's Cove and Cappuccino, and then was Cappuccino and Monastero in East Hampton, yeah.
It's a lot of work.
It was, but to me, the restaurant business is fun, you know. Some people hate it.
It's like being married, though, isn't
but
it?
To me, I enjoy what I'm doing.
Right.
And I love people. You know, that is one thing. I love people, so they never bother me, no matter what. You know, and I make a living.
Right.
So that's a plus-plus, so right?
It's a win-win, so, exactly.
And I've been very fortunate that, you know, people patronize me.
Yeah. You've been very successful. One of the things, I know you're a man of many firsts. You brought the first cappuccino machine to the East End. And I imagine that's how Il Cappuccino started with the name, right?
Yeah.
But one of the things a lot of people aren't familiar with is that you were the organizer of the Sag Harbor Chamber of Commerce.
As a matter of fact, Nada Berry and I and Dave, we were the founder. When I was in Barron's Cove, they had the round table, of which was more or less functioning as a chamber, but it was more a social club than anything else. So then we got together because there were no, at that time, 1965, 66.
What was Sag Harbor like at that time?
Well, we had till, you know, we had Bulova functioning, Grumman, and there was a Sag Harbor industry. Was activity. We didn't have much tourism as we have it.
Today.
Today we live after tourism. So even Main Street was suffering. There were a lot of stores closed. And we said, we got to do something, you know, because we were all in business and we, and that's how we found the chamber and we started promoting. And then from there, you know, went on and we started, you know, with the Whaler Festival at that time with John Steinbeck, you know, he was a Grand Marshal. And we had this international race, you know, Barry Brother, they were very helpful of that. And they sponsored them, and that's why we start building. In the beginning, it was a little rough, but I have to tell a little short story. You know, Dave, he was Jewish, and of course, I'm Italian. So to get the membership, we walked through Main Street, and we stopped in every store, and we said, this is a kosher Nostrum. And we have and we have an offer you can refuse. And he said, well, he said, we want to become a member of the Chamber of Commerce. And so that was fun.
Was Ivan's Shoes then? Was that there at the
Ivan,
time?
Ivan, it was, yeah, Ivan's Shoe Store was still there in the corner where it's now
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Must have been an interesting time. I mean, the Black Buoy was there at that time, too.
Oh, Black Buoy, the sandbar across the street, you know.
They had a lot of entertainment there, didn't they?
Yes. Sometimes even physical entertainment.
Right, that's what I meant.
But it changed a lot, Sag Harbor.
Yeah.
And the same for the better.
Yes. I mean, it's people. That's the place people want to be now, it seems like, Sag Harbor. You know, which is great. You know, I think it's fabulous. It goes without saying that your meals are really fabulous, Jack, but who's your chef and how'd you guys meet?
Well, my chef, that's another story, you see. I'm full of stories.
Okay, we got 2 minutes.
Okay, but Jim Renner is my chef. He's been with me since he was about 17, 18 years old. He started as a busboy. Then I brought him in the kitchen and I trained him. And he's been with me since.
He's he has not left.
Is now he's 56.
Wow.
So think about it. Right. And of course we had different, you know, second chef, third chef. You know, now we have a crew of four chefs in there, including him.
But I mean, it all stems from what you imparted. I mean, because you go there and the meals are fabulous. I mean, your sauce, the you know, it's that Northern Italian.
We never change our recipe. Our recipes always stay the same. What we do, we try to get a very, you know, a variety of special, because you know the menu, the our regular menu is typical Italian, but you know we have a repeated business, so we try to offer something different every week, so people don't get bored to
eat the same. Exactly.
Never to say that. A lot of people come in and always eat the,
same thing. Because it's so good, right? Anyway, Jack, it's been a delight having you on the program. And this is John Christopher, and we'll be right back with our next guest, Andrew Lieb of Lieb at Law. Welcome back to Real Life, and this is your host, John Christopher, and I have with me today Andrew Lieb of Lieb at Law. Hey, Andrew, how are you?
Well, I'm doing deceptively well today, John. How are you doing?
That leads me right into talking about deceptive and misleading advertising. But before we go there, you know, you have a real estate school, so I just want to I had taken this course, and I found it very fascinating, and I think it's the kind of thing for continuing education that's great for real estate agents. And what is the school called, and can you give us a little background on it?
Sure, I can. It's called LEAB School, like Long Island Education Board School.com. And at LEAB School, we have online and in-person education. Our online and in-person education reaches about 8,500 students in New York State. We do tons and tons and tons and tons of continuing ed. In fact, tomorrow night we're teaching the condo course. We're going to be launching that. We have some other cool courses coming up, like selling a business. But what we really do, John, is we've realized that real estate brokerage is a profession. And we've realized that there's so many people out there that don't take it seriously. And we've determined that if we give the tools to the real professionals out there, they'll stand out from all the rest. So an individual like yourself says to yourself, I want to learn how to be doing everything on the up and up. And you really differentiate yourself on the market, and that's why we've become friends over these years.
Thank you. Thank you. That's very kind of you to say. Andrew, so let's talk about some of the things about deceptive and misleading advertising. Why do they have...
How can you keep coming to me with deceptive? You just think everything about me is deceptive? Thanks,
well,
John.
That was the course that I learned. Actually, I came to your class, and it was fascinating, actually, because I enjoyed it because it was very... You're entertaining plus also educational, so the combination is a great combo. But anyway, let me go to the first question. We're talking about ad regulations that are imposed by what? The state, the federal government? But what about, we have freedom of speech. Why do we have to be regulated if we can be free to say what we have to say according to the First Amendment?
What a great question. And shouldn't we be able to say whatever we want to say?
Yeah.
John, I should be able to say to all my clients, you give me $1 million and you win every case. I should be able to say to all my clients, you come see me and you get to buy a house for $10. Because at the end of the day, your real question is, you're saying, why is there restrictions on speech if there's free speech? But guess what? Commercial speech is different than normal speech. You see, when you're trying to sell something, it's not free speech. It's commercial. It's a special subset of speech where aren't we concerned about the public at large understanding it is what they're getting, what they're buying? And we have to regulate people because, after all, can you just do brokerage and wake up one day? Or are you licensed to do brokerage by the state? So to answer all your questions in one, is that the state regulates, because the federal government said that they could regulate, and the branch of the federal government that said they could regulate is the Supreme Court. And what the Supreme Court said is that you can regulate misleading and dishonest speech in the commercial sector.
So that's why we have these certain guidelines that we have to follow then, correct?
Well, imagine going to the supermarket, right? And instead of it saying broccoli, it says superhuman food that makes you run really, really fast. Imagine going, no, seriously, like imagine you drive, instead of a sign that would say something auto group, it would say amazing flying machines. Right. People would just make up, so we have to protect consumers. And I think what you found so fascinating, at least what I was trying to project was so fascinating, is the degree that people are trying to deceive. When we were teaching the class and you were in that classroom, how many people raised their hand and said, could I get away with this? Could
right.
I get away with this?
Right.
Could I get away with this? Like, why? Why can't people just sell by saying it is what it is? And right. That's what the regulations are about. The regulations say, you know what? Let's not call spit rain when it's spit.
Right. Yeah, it makes sense. What about photography? You know, a lot of times you'll see... in ads, you know, and I've had this with showing homes that the house doesn't necessarily look like what it is in reality. Is there any regulation to that, or is it just falls under puffery?
I love the way how kind you put it. The house doesn't look the way it is. Like the house you go to, you look at the picture, it's three stories with a balcony overlooking the water. You go there, it's a half of a story, and it's got a little swamp in the backyard.
Right.
Like that's how the degree of change, it's not like a subtle change. So the answer to your question is, isn't it deceptive and misleading? And so you asked at the course, and I'll repeat right now so everyone knows, there's two different categories of ways that speech is regulated when it comes to real estate brokerage and sales. One is there's a statute that just uses the word deceptive and misleading. And that's a catch-all. But then we have a regulation at 19 New York Code of Rules and Regulations, Part 175.25, which illustrates specific things that are wrong or right. When it comes to pictures and manipulating pictures, that's just a general thing. It's misleading unless, because what you're getting at is these photoshopped. Aren't we hiring an art director to change it and look better? Isn't that why they're hiring a broker? And there's nothing wrong with that, John. What's wrong with it is when you don't put a disclaimer that says these images have been manipulated and do not accurately represent the property as it currently exists. Now, if they were to say that on it, there's nothing wrong because then you know what you're looking at. But if you were to go there and you expect the Taj Mahal and instead you get Rudolph the Dog's Hall, there's a big problem.
And it's happened. It's happened. So, but you never,
probably
I've never
every
seen
day in your life.
Right. I have yet to see that. I've seen where people will put in a pool and most people, and it's small lettering. And I'll have a client call me and say, let's go take a look at that house. It's got a great looking pool. And if you don't read the fine print, you can barely see it sometimes. It says, pool is added.
I want to address that, what you just said.
Go ahead.
Because I was teaching a compliance class yesterday, and one of the agents said to me in the class, it was for brokers, I was at a company, I do compliance for companies, one of the agents raised their hand and she says to me, well, if my client finds a property and they could go on their own, why would they want me?
Interesting.
And I said to them back, is your job to be a matchmaker or a evaluator? Because the internet could help you find property. I'll bet you, John, your clients can find the house before you can find the house.
Absolutely.
That's really not what you're doing, right? Zillow's got it. You got it on Stratus. You got it on Realtor.com. You could find, it's on Facebook, people are advertising every day. So what is it that a buyer's agent's really doing? Knowing to look for the fine print.
Right.
Isn't that what you're really doing? Isn't the reason they're coming to John Christopher, as opposed to going on their own and looking at the property, John Christopher says to them, listen, before we go there, let me do my due diligence. In English, that means I'm going to actually research what we're buying. Maybe you would go over, say we're in Sag Harbor, you go over to the Village, you go to the Village and you say, clerk, could I have the CO for this property? When you get the CO, you see if they have actually a legal pool. See, you and I are talking about manipulating pictures, but advertising goes even further. What happens if there really is a pool? What happens if it's really not manipulated? And what happens if it's an accurate picture, but it's illegal?
Oh.
Meaning they never got permits from the town. Isn't right. that still deceptive advertising?
Yep. I would think so.
So I'm going to tell you my favorite one, and this is in the industry, as you and I are talking about what a broker knows. John, when you see the word bonus room, that's what something they write,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah,
yep.
They write bonus room. What does that mean to a broker when they write bonus room? See, I'm flipping this.
Means,
you're supposed to, I know.
Well, it's supposed to be a bedroom, but you can't say a bedroom because the town says you have three bedrooms, and really you're trying to sell four bedrooms, but you can't say there are four bedrooms because it's not legal, correct?
So isn't that fabulous, what John just said? What John just told you is that they're trying to say by the word bonus room that it's a detriment room. Does everyone hear that? I want everyone to hear that. John said that there's only three legal bedrooms, and they would call it four bedrooms if it was legal, but they're calling it three bedrooms and a bonus room because it's illegal. So what happens when you get that illegal room? Let's say you're the buyer, and you go buy that, and you get that illegal room. Well, nothing happens, right, John? Nothing happens until your neighbor complains to the town and code enforcement comes. And when code enforcement comes, and they say, by the way, here's a ticket, and by the way, we're going to continually every week give you a ticket, and you're going to continually have to pay this until you remediate the issue, meaning rip out the illegal structure, get the appropriate permits, get the COs. That's what's going to happen. So you and I just had a very fascinating conversation. We started off with it doesn't exist, and the Photoshop manipulated it to be there. But what happens when it actually exists, but legally it shouldn't be there?
Right.
My compliance course yesterday said, what does a buyer's agent do? That's what a buyer's agent does.
Exactly. Well, Andrew, as I said earlier, it's always delightful having you on the program. You're very educational. If somebody needed to get some legal advice or at least some of your legal acumen, how could they do that?
The easiest way is just give me a buzz on the telephone, 646-216-8009. 646-216-8009. We have a team of attorneys that could help anyone.
And they're a fantastic team. Thank you, Andrew, so much for coming on the program.
This is John Christopher for Real Life on Peconic Public Broadcasting, 88.3, right here in Southampton, New York. By the way, if you're interested in hearing this program again or previous ones, you can go to PeconicPublicBroadcasting.org and subscribe to the podcast. Until next time, looking forward to seeing you soon, and have a safe journey.
You have been listening to Real Life, the program that talks to the people, places, and things that are the pulse and heartbeat of real estate on the East End. Your host has been John Christopher, broker associate with Sotheby's International Realty. Your producer and engineer is Kyle Lynch, theme music by John Christopher. Questions and comments can be emailed to john.christopher@sotheby'shomes.com. Real Life is also brought to you in part by LEAP Compliance, HR's one-stop solution for sexual harassment prevention training and policies. All employers in the New York State are now required to train all employees annually, no matter the size of the company. For more information, discriminationpreventiontraining.com or 646-216-8038.